WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. When Mario Vargas Llosa lost his bid for the presidency of Peru, the literary world breathed a sigh of relief. Instead of being bogged down with the details of running Peru's embattled government, Vargas Llosa could continue his writing. Mario Vargas Llosa is Peru's leading author. His books include The Storyteller, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, The Greenhouse, and several volumes of literary essays. Vargas Llosa's latest novel, In Praise of the Stepmother, has recently been translated into English. It explores the erotic relationship between the stepmother Doña Lucrecia, Don Rigoberto, her husband, and Alfonso, his pre-adolescent son. Erotica is a theme that has interested Vargas Llosa for some time now. He once said that he preferred pornography to science fiction. I asked him to explain.
Well, I wrote that in a context in which I was trying to explain why, in general, I was more sympathetic to concrete things and activities than to abstract ones. And I think that maybe pornography is much more concrete, let's say, than science fiction. The feeling of irreality is less in pornographic text than in science fiction text. But in general, I don't like pornography. I become very bored, you know, with pornographic texts because the poorness of their style, of their formal artistry.
Does it require a different kind of imagination to write erotica, something obviously different from pornography?
Well, you have to establish what is the difference between eroticism and pornography. I think the difference is that pornography is eroticism badly written, badly realized. I think an erotic story well written is eroticism, badly written is pornography. I think this is the only, well, objective kind of differences that you can establish between eroticism and pornography.
And do they have different ends, do you think?
That is very difficult to say. What is the end of literature in general, of art in general? That's a very complicated theme. I don't think the aims are important, you know. I think what is really important in art is the realization. If you write a good novel, an important novel, something that enrich the language, the imagination, well, the results of this would be diverse, very different for different persons, for different times. And in any case, these results or consequences won't be those that the author project or wanted. You know, so I think what is important in art is the realization, the actual production of something that is authentic, creative, original, persuasive, beautiful. If you achieve this, I think the results would be positive in any way.
So for you, there's no different kind of approach to what you're writing if it is erotica versus anything else. I mean, what you're talking about is using the same kind of imagination, drawing from that same well of imagination.
I think so. But, you know, I accept to call this book an erotic novel because it is true that physical love has a major role in the story. But I am not in favor, you know, of this kind of labels put into novels, because this is a reduction of what a novel is. I think a novel, the nature of the genre is to embrace a wide variety of human experiences. I think this is what is connatural to the novel. And if you reduce a novel to the description of only one exclusive experience in the world, for instance, sex, physical love, you reduce the horizon, the scope of a genre which has been created to express the totality of the human experience. In my book, for instance, in Praise of the Stepmother, it is true, physical love is essential, but there are other aspects of experience which are also very important. Rituals, for instance. Well, the function of rituals in life. Utopias, the function of collectivistic and individual utopias in life. Painting, plastic imagination is something also important in the book. So it's not exclusively about physical love.
I would like you to read a passage from your book, and this is about Don Rigoberto performing one of his many rituals, and he has set aside certain evenings to attend to certain parts of his body, his nose, his skin, his feet, his hair. And in this passage, it's a ritual that he does to cleanse his ears, which you describe as conch shells.
Tonight, I shall not make love, but hear it, he decided. That was possible. He had done it so on other occasions, and it amused Lucrezia too, at least as part of the prolegomena. Let me hear your breasts, he would murmur, enamorously plugging his wife's nipples, first one and then the other, into the hypersensitive cavern of his two ears, which they fit into as snugly as a foot into a moccasins. He would listen to them with his eyes closed, reverent and ecstatic, his mind worshipfully concentrated as at the elevation of the host, till he heard ascending to the earthy rockness of each button from subterranean carnal depths certain stifled cadences, the heavy breathing perhaps of her pores opening, the boiling perhaps of her excited blood.
Do you think of cleansing or cleaning as an erotic act in itself?
Well, anything can be erotic, you know. We know now that sex is not something that can be exclusively related to sexual organs in the body, that sex is part of the totality of the human experience. And but in the case of Don Rigoberto, the character of this book, he has assumed this and has transformed this in a ceremony, in a ritual that he practices every day. He prepares himself to make love with his wife, cleaning his body, not in a purely functional way, but transforming this act in something that can have, let's say, religious overtones. It's a ceremony in which he participates with great love, concentration, enthusiasm, even a kind of a spiritual joy. He cleans his body to perform something that for him represents a kind of absolute. The happiness for Don Rigoberto comes through this secret ceremonies that he performs with himself alone and with his wife. He has built a kind of utopia, a private utopia, and he thinks that in this way he's been able to achieve happiness.
Getting back to what you were saying about rituals, is it the time that it takes to perform the ritual and for Don Rigoberto, the kind of secrecy involved in the ritual that makes it erotic?
Yes, I think this is an important aspect of eroticism, secrecy. Eroticism is, I don't think it's something that can be called municipal or collectivistic. Mm-hmm. I think It's probably one of the moral justifications for eroticism. If we want to defend and to preserve the individual, and if we want the individual not to dissolve in the collective world, a risk that exists, particularly in modern industrial developed societies, we have to give to the individuals many reasons to defend his identity. And eroticism is one way of achieve this. Eroticism is something that has to do with individuals, not with masses, not with it's not a collective experiences.
I ask that because another part of your book is the game, in a sense, that's going on between the stepmother and the stepson. He is watching her as she makes love with her husband or as she takes a bath, and she knows that. And it's the relationship between the spire and the spied. I'm interested in what it is about that relationship that you find interesting.
Well, what I think it's interesting in this relation, it's the fact that it's very difficult to establish who seduces to whom in the book. Is it the child who seduces the stepmother? Because the child apparently is a very innocent boy, and he acts without, let's say, deliberation. He acts like boys used to do.
They're innocent hugs and kisses that he gives his stepmother.
He plays. He's something that apparently is very spontaneous. But you can discover there that there is probably very deep and hidden some malice in it. And on the other hand, the stepmother, in spite of herself, she has strong convictions, and she tries to not to respond in a, let's say, in an erotic way to what is going on. In spite of that, she is pushed by something dark and hidden in herself, attraction of the risk, maybe, towards this relationship.
You ran for president of Peru, and I'm curious whether this novel was being read in Peru while you were running your campaign.
It was published during the campaign, yes. And, it was even used by my adversary against me. There were programs in the television trying to prove that I was a pornographer, and so that it was a great risk to put a pornographer in the presidency. But I don't think it has much effect in the result of the election.
Well, I do have to laugh because I think in our own presidential campaigns, we have politicians who are afraid to say the word taxes, much less to write about what you wrote about, the way you wrote about it.
Yes, well, I know that there is in the States a debate about problems of censorship and something that I think it's a great pity, because on the other hand, the United States is such a free society. You have this very refreshing feeling that here anything can be questioned, that you can have the opportunity to challenge everything that is established. So I don't think how can this match with censor for art or for books. I hope this didn't prosper.
Are you at all relieved that you actually lost the election for president of Peru?
From a personal point of view, without any doubt, of course, because it would have been very, very difficult. I was disappointed because I had worked very hard with many people in order, to present a program of changes. But from a personal point of view, I was very happy to be returned to my books, to my studio, to what is really my vocation. Politics was never my vocation. I accepted to run for moral reasons, not for political reasons.
Well, why did you want to be president? And are moral reasons then more important than personal ones in your country?
Well, you know, there are circumstances in the life of a nation in which everybody has the obligation to participate in politics, in social life, like it or not, because when I entered into politics, we were living in Peru, an atmosphere, you know, in which it seems that it was a great enthusiasm for the kind of liberal reforms that I think are necessary in order to overcome poverty, underdevelopment, barbarism. It was an illusion. It wasn't like that, you know, but that's what we thought, we believed, and it was so. I thought it was my obligation to try to do something about it.
Why do you think you lost?
Well, putting it simply, I think because there was a majority of Peruvians who were not prepared to accept the kind of society that we thought we need to create in order to become modern and prosperous. You know, they were afraid of this free market reform that would transfer all the public sector to the private initiative. And I think the populist tradition, which is very, very strong in Peru and in Latin America, prevailed at the end against the kind of liberalism that I was offering. So I think it was really an intellectual or even a philosophical choice. It was a choice against liberal, modern democracy and in favor of what has been the traditional mercantilist system that Peru and most Latin American countries have been had since, well, at least the beginning of the 19th century.
I think many people ask themselves more and more why anyone wants to run any country. And I know in Peru there's enormous problems of unemployment or underemployment, inflation, drought, drug trafficking, a guerrilla war. Could you have actually been still a novelist and tried to take care of some of these serious problems? And I guess I'm even comparing the sort of public life of the politician versus the private life that a writer needs.
No, if I had to win the election during the 5 years of the presidency, I would have been totally unable to write novels and to have any serious literary activity. No, I think there is total incompatibility. You know, you can't really do both things. They are identically absorbing. They require total dedication. No, I knew that, you know, and that was one of the reasons why I was so reluctant and why it took me some time to accept, you know, because I knew that it would have been for me at least 5 years without writing and probably without reading any interesting literary book, you know.
Well, our writer John Updike said that novelists see all sides of a subject that a politician only sees one. Do you agree with that? And would you have had a problem of almost too much vision?
Well, yes, you know, when you enter into politics, you think that politics is about ideas, about imagination, about values. And in fact, you discover that 99% of the time, politics is intriguing, you know, it's maneuvering, it's a very cynical game of maneuvering in order to conquest power. And this is probably the most depressing aspect of doing politics. On the other hand, you can't dismiss politics because if you want to change things in society, you have to pass through politics in order to do it. But you must know that politics is in itself something not only very dirty, but also very boring and very mediocre, and that you must have a tremendous conviction and make tremendous efforts and to use all kind of skills if you don't want to be destroyed and mediocrized by the practical politics.
Do writers and poets in Central America, South America, in Peru have more status? I mean, does their word count for something more than the politicians' words? Because I think in this country, we can't trust what we hear anymore from politicians. And I think with a writer, there has to be a kind of trust between the reader and the writer, and that trust comes through those words. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, I think it is true. In Latin America, writers, poets enjoy a kind of respectability for what they say in non-literary matters, you know? They are supposed to give advice and ideas and suggestions practically about everything. This is the old romantic idea of the writer, as somewhat with answers for all the questions of humanity. It's a very naive vision, no? It's a very naive, it's not true that writers have answers for everything. But it's a very, I think, exciting idea of literature. It's the idea that in literature you can find answers for everything. And this, I think, in a way, is true. I think good books, great poems, marvelous novels give you answers for many, many things that you in daily life don't know how to solve.
Can you then do more as a writer than you could have done as a president?
Oh, well, without any doubt. The problem is that there are moments in which the things that are needed to be done should be done rapidly, immediately, in collective terms, in economic and social terms. And this is not the way in which books influence and change society. I am convinced that books are not gratuitous, that a good book is something that has a lasting effect in a society. But let's use a very graphic example. If you were a French writer in 1939, when the Nazi armies invaded France, well, at that moment, the problem was to fight and to defend France, democracy against Nazism. And the way to do it was not to write poems, you know. You can write poems, of course, and it's fine. But at that moment, what was necessary was a more effective and concrete action. I think this is not diminishing in any way the role of literature, but literature changes things slowly, changing people who read and changing the way of thinking and the way of perceiving things by people. And there are circumstances in which this is not enough, you know.
Novelist Mario Vargas Llosa, his new book is In Praise of the Stepmother. One of Vargas Llosa's earlier novels, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, is being made into a film. It stars Barbara Hershey and Peter Falk.